What we don't realize is that while we enjoy the things that are good in this world, over time, some of these things become ruling things. And slowly, they become things that take up our affections and contend for our hearts. And over time, we may not even realize it, but we become more and more secular and less faithful to God. And so C.S. Lewis actually captures this in the Screwtape Letters, this book that he writes, where he kind of writes as though he is a demon who's giving counsel to his nephew on how to tempt believers. And so he writes from the perspective of a demon. He says, "Prosperity knits a man to the world. He feels that he is finding his place in it, while really it is finding its place in him. His increasing reputation, his widening circle of acquaintances, his sense of importance, the growing pressure of absorbing and agreeable work, build up in him a sense of being really at home in earth," this book, right? "Which is just what we," remember this is from the perspective of a demon, "what we want." Now, most of us would never say out loud that we're trying to serve two kings or live in two worlds, but if we're honest, most of us can sense this tension in our hearts. We want to follow Jesus, but we also want to fit in. We want to be liked. We want to stay in control. We want to be comfortable. We don't want to give up anything if we don't have to. We want to be in God's kingdom and the world's. We want the crown, but we don't really want the cross. And so here in 1 Samuel 20, what we're going to see is a man, Jonathan, who is forced to choose between his loyalty to two kings. On the one hand, God's king, and on the other hand, the world's king. And so I kind of made a mistake because I chose to jump into a chapter 20 with no context. So I'm going to have to do a lot of work setting this up. Last week, Ben went over four chapters of Jonah, and we're just going to fly through 19 chapters of 1 Samuel. Right, so Clifton told me I have to be done in under 90 minutes. Amen. We had this conversation, right?
Yeah.
So, I'm new. I don't know what I'm talking about. So he told me 90 minutes. It's all right. I'll be done in under. So let's go through the first 19 chapters. And as we do this, I want you to listen for the contrast in these chapters between God's chosen king, David, and the people's chosen king, Saul. All right? So, beginning, 1 Samuel, the nation of Israel is at war with the Philistines, and it is a time when God ruled over the nation through a line of judges. In the first seven chapters, God raises up Samuel as a prophet and to judge over Israel on his behalf. But in chapter 8, things start to not go so well. That's usually when we're tempted to doubt God, to ask God to obey us, because we think we can fix things, right? And so the nation, they demand a king. But they don't demand a king that is God's king. They demand a king so that they can be like all the nations, which is what it says in chapter 8. And then it says, "And that our king, not God, may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." And this is actually what God had previously promised that he was going to do for them. But they didn't want God to do that for them. They wanted a king of their own choosing, a human king to do that for them. And so God, through Samuel, he warns the people in 1 Samuel 8, verses 11 through 17. Samuel says, and listen to this, "These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you, your chosen king. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipments of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and your vineyards and give it to his officers and his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves." And this is a description of what the world's rulers are like. And it's an accurate description, right? We look around and this is exactly what our rulers are like. This is exactly what our politicians are like and what the wealthy are like and those who rule this world. But the people refuse to listen. So in chapter 8, verse 22, God says to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. And so in chapter 9 through 10, God presents Saul. And this is the king that Israel asked for. He is outwardly impressive. He's described as a handsome young man. It says, there was not a man among the people of Israel who was more handsome than he. From his shoulders upward, he was taller than any of the people. So then in chapters 11 through 12, things are starting to look good. Saul is leading the nation to victory in battle, just as the people had hoped. But soon after that, we see in chapters 13 through 15, that Saul, while he is outwardly impressive, while he is the king that they asked for, he really is the king that they asked for. He is inwardly impatient and cowardly, lacking faith and obedience. He is arrogant, and he is showing himself to be that king. And ultimately, that leads to God rejecting Saul as their king in chapter 15, or ultimately as his king. And so in chapter 16, what God does is he goes and he secretly anoints his own king. Not the king that the people chose, but the king that God chooses. And this is King David. And God's selection of David is based on a completely different set of qualifications. 1 Samuel 16:7, it says, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him, Saul. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. And so God rejects Saul, who is outwardly good, and he is looking for a king who has a pure heart. So David is anointed, and he eventually ends up through a series of circumstances in the service of Saul. Right, so we have at this point the people's chosen king. He's ruling, but he's rejected by God. We have David, who is secretly anointed. He is now serving Saul. And then chapter 17, you probably all know this story, David and Goliath. David, who is nobody, he defeats Goliath, who is the champion of the Philistines. And at this point, his reputation begins to grow. Saul notices who he is. And in chapter 18, there's quite a few things that happen. First, Saul's own son, Jonathan, who's going to be the main person we're focused on in the chapter we're going to look at, he becomes a close friend of David. So in chapter 18, verses 1 and 3, it actually describes their friendship. It says, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. So this was a deep and abiding friendship. This was a covenant friendship. It was not just a shallow acquaintance, but they truly loved one another. They truly had a covenant relationship. Next thing that happens is that as David's reputation grows, Saul begins to realize that God's favor is actually with David. And so Saul becomes jealous and fearful. So in verse 12 it says, Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. And so what does Saul do? Saul makes David a commander in his army. Not as a blessing, but because his hope is that as a commander in his army, he will have to battle the Philistines, and that he might actually be killed battling the Philistines. But as David prospers in battle, his reputation continues to grow, and Saul grows more and more jealous. And so one day, in his jealousy, this is still in chapter 18, Saul becomes so angry with David, as David's just sitting in the room playing a musical instrument, the lyre, that Saul hurls a spear at David to kill him. And then David hides, he evades Saul, they seem to reconcile. And so David continues to serve Saul, and he actually continues to win victories for Saul. And Saul actually gives his own daughter to David in marriage. And even uses this marriage as a plot to try to kill David. In chapter 19, Saul at first promises to Jonathan that he will not kill David. He swears in chapter 19, verse 6, he says, as the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death. But then again, in chapter 19, his jealousy causes him to become so angry with David that he hurls a spear at David again. And so then David runs away. He's in hiding. And Saul sends assassins to kill David in his own home while he's sleeping in his bed, but David escapes. So David flees to hide where Samuel is living, and Saul sends assassins multiple times to try to kill David. Each time God protects David, until finally Saul himself goes and tries to kill David, but God protects him again. And so at this point, you're looking at Saul, and you might be thinking, there is something seriously wrong with this dude, right? Like he is supposed to be the king, but he is slowly losing his mind. But really, this is the world's king. He is power hungry, and he will do anything to stay in power. And as he sees David rising in power, that is what's causing him to lose his mind. So we come to the story that we're in now, 1 Samuel 20. And what we find is now we have our two kings that are set up, and God's king is persecuted by Saul. And in between these two kings, we have Jonathan. He is an example to us of incredible faith because he's forced to make a choice. One king is his own father, who is unrighteous and persecuting God's king, who is his dear friend. And so we'll pick up in 1 Samuel 20, starting in verse 1. It says, "Then David fled from Noah in Ramah," and that's where Saul was hiding, or where he was hiding with Saul, with Samuel. "And he came before Jonathan, came and said before Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my guilt? What is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?'" So notice David's humility here. Even after multiple attempts on his life, David is actually seeking to be reconciled to Saul. He could have stayed in hiding. He could have gone far, far away to avoid persecution, but he's actually seeking to be reconciled to Saul. And a few Sundays ago, we were in Luke 17 talking about forgiveness. We're talking about how difficult it is to forgive someone if they sin against you 7 times in one day. And here's David. He's trying to forgive and seek reconciliation with a man who's tried to kill him at least 7 times that I counted. And so David's doing this from a place of humility. He's actually asking, am I at fault here? Do I have sin? Is Saul actually justified in trying to kill me? And he's hoping to return to Saul's service. This is the faithfulness of God's king. Verse 2, "And he, Jonathan, said to him, 'Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me, and why should my father hide this from me? It is not so.'" Notice that Jonathan, he doesn't exactly answer David's question here. Right? David is asking, "Why is your father trying to kill me?" And Jonathan's like, "My father? I don't think so. He would tell me," right? So Jonathan's not telling David that the reason he's not going to die is because he's righteous, but he's actually in denial. See, up until this point, Jonathan's life has been pretty good. He's the son, like we said, he's the son of the king, he's the friend of God's anointed king, and maybe in his blindness, he has never been confronted with the possibility of these two kings being in opposition to one another. And so he would prefer not to make a choice. But David presses him. Verse 3, it says, "But David bowed again, saying, 'Your father knows well that I have found favor in your eyes.' And he thinks, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death.' Then Jonathan said to David, 'Whatever you say, I will do for you.'" You can get a sense of David's patience as he's reasoning with Jonathan here. Even as David feels that he could be killed any day now. And as Jonathan is confronted with this reality of the situation, he chooses to be faithful with David. So David forms a plan for Jonathan to confirm Saul's intention in verse 5. It says, "David said to Jonathan, 'Behold, tomorrow is the new moon,'" which is just another way of saying the new month, "'and I should not fail to sit at table with the king.'" So Saul probably had some sort of gathering or feast at the beginning of each month, where all of his commanders, all of his advisors would gather together and maybe feast together. And David would have been expected at this gathering. And maybe this is the reason that David returned. And continues, David continues, "But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field till the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city. For there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the clan. If he says good, it will be well with your servant. If he says good, then it will be well with your servant. But if he is angry, then know that harm is determined by him. So David's plan is that he's going to be absent from this gathering. And depending on Saul's response, you get a clue as to Saul's intention. You know, if Saul is okay with David's absence, then that might be a clue that he's not trying to kill David. But if Saul is angry about his absence, then maybe Saul is hoping that David will return because he's obligated to, and that will be the opportunity for Saul to kill him. Verse 8, "Therefore, deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is guilt in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father?" And so you can sense here that David, as he's pleading with Jonathan, as he's talking to Jonathan, he's still not sure if he can trust Jonathan. He's asking, "Jonathan, you're not going to betray me, are you? If you're going to betray me, just kill me now. Let's get this over with." And sometimes it's that anticipation and dread of danger that's actually worse than the danger itself, right? And so you can feel David's fear here and his predicament. Verse 9, "And Jonathan said, far be it from you. If I knew that it was determined by my father that harm should come to you, would I not tell you? Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you roughly?" And I think David might be asking two questions here. One is that if your own life is in danger, Jonathan, then will you continue to be faithful to me, or will you betray me? And then two, assuming you are faithful, how will you let me know of Saul's intent without risking our lives? And so you see why Jonathan then answers in this way. And Jonathan said to David, "Come, let us go out into the field." So they both went out into the field. And at this point, I think if I was David, I'd be wondering, why are we going into the field? Like, are you looking for a place to kill me, maybe bury me? And Jonathan said to David, "The Lord, the God of Israel, be witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day, behold, if he is well disposed toward David, shall I not then send and disclose it to you? But should it please my father to do you harm, the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also, if I do not disclose it to you and send you away." So he's promising to David, "I will not betray you, that you may go in safety. But the Lord be with you, as he has been with my father," which is a way of Jonathan telling David that he will be the rightful king after Saul. The Lord was with Saul previously as Saul is king, and when David will be king in the future, which is certain because he is God's chosen king, God will be with him. Verse 14, Jonathan continues, "If I am still alive, show me the steadfast love of the Lord, that I may not die. And do not cut off your steadfast love from my house forever, when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." And Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "May the Lord take vengeance on David's enemies." And Jonathan made David swear again by his love for him. For he, Jonathan, loved him, David, as he loved his own soul. So Jonathan here, he knows something. He knows that God's favor is with David, and that David will be the next king. But he also knows that he is Saul's son. So by birth, he's actually an enemy of the king. In those days, it was expected that when one king replaced another, that the new king would actually wipe out all of the descendants of the former king. And it makes sense, because the kings would not want a descendant to seek vengeance or to attempt to reclaim the throne. And this is the expectation. And so by making a covenant with David, what Jonathan is doing here, he's actually sentencing himself and his descendants to death. He's putting his life in David's hands. So Jonathan asks David for mercy based on their covenant friendship and their love for one another. He's asking, when you come into power, and it's expected that you should wipe away all your enemies and all of their descendants, Show me undeserved mercy. Show undeserved mercy, not just to me, but to my descendants. And so David makes a covenant with him, and it says it's because of he loves him as his own soul. Verse 18, then Jonathan said to him, tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed, because your seat will be empty. On the third day, go down quickly to the place where you hid yourself when the matter was in hand, and remain beside the stone heap. And I will shoot three arrows to the side of it, as though I shot at a mark. And behold, I will send a boy, saying, go find the arrows. If I say to the boy, look, the arrows are on this side of you, take them. Then you are to come, for as the Lord lives, it is safe for you, and there is no danger. But if I say to the youth, look, the arrows are beyond you, then go, for the Lord has sent you away. So this is the plan that Jonathan comes up with to communicate to David safely. And he says, and as for the matter of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between you and me forever. Which means that God is our bond. Because our covenant, my covenant with you, is with God. In other words, you can trust me. Verse 24. So David hid himself in the field. And when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. The king sat on a seat, as at other times, on the seat by the wall. Jonathan sat opposite, and Abner, which is Saul's cousin and his the commander of his army, sat by Saul's side. But David's place is empty. So you can see here, kind of, the author is setting up the scene, and Saul is sitting on one side, and Abner is sitting next to him, and opposing him is Jonathan. So kind of the implication is that where is David's empty seat? Probably next to Jonathan, opposed to Saul and Abner, right? Yet Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean. And that's really ironic, because Saul here is focused on thinking that David might be ceremonially unclean. That by some ceremonial law, David has made himself unclean. But if we examine hearts, remember, God is looking for a king. When he was looking for a king, he was examining hearts. We know that Saul is actually the one who's unclean. And David is actually clean. Verse 27, but on the second day, the day after the new moon, David's place was still empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has not the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go, for our clan holds a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. So now, if I have found favor in your eyes, let me get away and see my brothers. For this reason, he has not come to the king's table. Then Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame? And to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. And remember previously he said, as long as the Lord lives, he shall not die. Right? And so Saul reveals his intentions here. But Saul reveals a concern here that is actually true. He says, as long as David prospers, your kingdom will not. And he's saying this to Jonathan. Because Jonathan is the prince at this point. He is the son of the king, and by showing loyalty to David, he is essentially giving up, he's sacrificing his own kingdom. He's giving up his own inheritance to this worldly throne. And the implication is clear here, that following God's king requires real sacrifice. And Jonathan is making the sacrifice. Sometimes we have our own kingdoms that we're building off to the side. And here we see Jonathan is willingly giving up his own kingdom. Verse 32, then Jonathan answered Saul his father, why should he be put to death? What has he done? So he's speaking truth here, right? But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. Which is funny, because I just imagine Saul sitting at the dining table. He's always got a spear in hand, just in case he wants to hurl it, right? But you see the implication here is kind of clear. This is exactly how he tried to kill David twice before, right? And so when you show loyalty to a persecuted king, you can expect to be subjected to the same kind of persecution. Verse 33 continues, so Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death. And as you read this, you're kind of thinking, I'm kind of thinking, Jonathan's not the brightest guy. Like, there were so many opportunities for him to realize this, and it took finally Saul throwing a spear at him to realize this. But remember that Jonathan he's sacrificing a lot by his loyalty to David, right? He is putting his life in David's hands. He is giving up his inherited kingdom. And truthfully, aren't we often like Jonathan? In that when our loyalties are conflicting in our heart, aren't we often also unwilling to make sacrifices in our lives for our faith? Aren't we often also in denial about these conflicting loyalties in our hearts so that we can keep all of them going at the same time? But at this point, there could be no more doubt in Jonathan's mind that these two kings in his life, they could not be reconciled. They could not be at peace. So he has to forsake one of them. And he already did. Verse 34, and Jonathan rose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month. For he was grieved for David because his father had disgraced him. In the morning, Jonathan went out into the field to the appointment with David, and with him a little boy. And he said to his boy, run and find the arrows that I shoot. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. And when the boy came to the place of the arrow that Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the boy and said, is not the arrow but beyond you? And Jonathan called after the boy, hurry, be quick, do not stay. So Jonathan's boy gathered up the arrows and came to his master. But the boy knew nothing. Only Jonathan and David knew the matter. So Jonathan delivered his message to David in secret. And Jonathan gave his weapons to his boy and said to him, go and carry them to the city. And as soon as the boy had gone, David rose from beside the stone heap. He fell on his face to the ground and bowed three times. And they kissed one another and wept with one another, David weeping the most. And so the original plan was that they would communicate in secret, and then David would go, right? But David breaks from his plan, and he risks his life to meet with Jonathan one last time. And so you can feel the sincere love that they have for one another. And this is the kind of king that God's king is. That he's willing to risk his life to show love to his covenant friends. Verse 41, then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever. Which again, remember that between me and you is that God is the one holding us together. And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So David departs a fugitive. He's God's anointed king, but he's persecuted and alone, running for his life. And Jonathan leaves too. He's now an enemy in his own household. He's loyal to God's anointed king, but he's also going to be persecuted like God's anointed king. And so how is he able to say, go in peace? It's because the Lord is between them forever. God is the one who has made covenant with David, and David has made covenant with Jonathan. And these covenants will be upheld by God. And so while they find themselves in a seemingly hopeless situation, as they depart, they have a hope that is in God's kingdom, which is not the moment, but which is to come. And just like David, or just like Jonathan follows David, we too follow a persecuted king. We follow a king who is God's chosen and anointed, but is hated by this world. So many of you have grown up in the church, and like Jonathan, you might know God's king. You've gone to Sunday school, you read your Bible, you learn about Jesus, and you might even consider yourself a Christian. You might be baptized, You might consider yourself a friend of God's King, Jesus. But like Jonathan, you might not realize that in your heart you have multiple loyalties that are competing for the throne. And it really can be tempting to believe that you can have one foot in God's kingdom and one foot in the world, and to just live your best life and still be in God's kingdom. That you can be a Christian while still being accepted by the world and enjoying all that it has to offer. And for a time, it might seem like these loyalties can coexist. But the truth is that you can only have one king in your heart. That as a follower of Christ, like Jonathan, you too will have to make difficult choices and sacrifices and forsake all other rulers that might be competing for your heart. Maybe some of you are facing these kinds of difficult decisions today. Or maybe you experience situations where you have to stand for the truth and you fear being ridiculed for it. Or maybe it's you're in situations where you know that you should show kindness and friendship to someone who's not well-liked among your friends. Or maybe you feel left out for abstaining from certain activities that you see all of your friends and the rest of the world freely partaking in, but knowing that it's sinful or foolish. And like Jonathan, you might be wrestling with these things. You know the right decision, but you may be in denial. And finally, there's another way that we are all kind of like Jonathan. Because like Jonathan, whose father was the enemy and persecutor of God's king, we also are natural born enemies of God. All of us are born into sin and into a world that opposes God. And maybe you are living for your own kingdom. Maybe you're building it with your good grades, with the hope of a future career that can give you the life that you want. Or maybe your kingdom looks different. Maybe your kingdom is just you being able to do whatever you want that is fun, whatever gives you pleasure, wasting your life, living as though you're accountable to no one, not even to God. You may think that you can be the ruler of your own life, but the truth is that there is a temporary ruler in this world. He does not love you. He makes promises that he does not keep. He is opposed to God. But God's King, Jesus, is the opposite. He is humble. He's kind, loving, faithful. He's lavishly generous, and he's merciful. And just like David was willing to reconcile with Saul and humbly seeking that reconciliation, even though Saul had tried to kill him multiple times, Jesus wants to be reconciled with you. He wants you to be reconciled to him. No matter what you've done, no matter where your heart is today, if you place your faith in Jesus, he will forgive you. Unlike the rulers of this world, God's King does keep his covenant promises, like David kept his covenant with Jonathan. And I want to show you how he kept his covenant with Jonathan in 2 Samuel chapter 9. I'll read from there. You can flip there with me if you want. But I'll skip around a little bit. Verse 1, it says, "And David said," and this is after David already became king, because Saul has died. "And David said, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" See, he remembers Jonathan. And instead of asking if there's anyone left in the house of Saul so I can wipe them out, his descendants, he's asking that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake. And skip down to verse 6. "And Mephibosheth, who was the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, Behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, Do not fear." Because Mephibosheth probably thought that he was being called to be killed. He knew what was expected. He knew that he was the son of the enemy. So David said, "Do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, and I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always." And then skipping down to verse 11, "So Mephibosheth ate at David's table like one of the king's sons." And so if you remember the promise that David made to Jonathan, David could have just left Mephibosheth alone. Or he could have just called Mephibosheth and said, go in peace. And that would have fulfilled the covenant. But he went above and beyond because of his generosity, because of the grace that he shows, because this is the kind of God, the kind of king that God, that Jesus is as well. That he not only let Mephibosheth live, but he also restored to Mephibosheth all of the land of his inheritance. And he invites him to eat at his table, and he treats him as his own son. And this is the generous mercy and kindness that God's King, Jesus, has for us. If you covenant with God's King, he will not treat you as an enemy. He will show you kindness. He will restore you and invite you to feast at his table as his own son, like David did with Mephibosheth. So which king will you follow? Let's pray. Father God, we are so thankful that we follow a king who is merciful and gracious and loving and kind, and who desires to covenant with us, and is lavishly generous. And I pray for all of our hearts that we would remember that as we're tempted by other things in this world, as our hearts are pulled in different directions, and we may be tempted to put other rulers on the throne of our hearts, that we would remember the kinds of rulers in this world, and we would remember the kind of ruler that you are, and just how good you are to us. And that like Jonathan, when we are in difficult situations and we're faced with difficult decisions, that we too would show the faith that Jonathan had. And I pray this in Jesus' name.